Recently, a friend of one of my adult children said to me, "So I hear you hate Catholicism." I explained that this was a rather large mischaracterization about my feelings about the Catholic Church, which I was raised in, and religion in general. It's not that I have anything against religion and spirituality, but I do admit that a lifetime of watching government and religion collide has led me to believe ever more strongly in the separation of church and state. Religious citizens, of course, will take their faith into account when they vote, but religious organizations, I firmly believe, have no place in politics. And that's where I start when I think about religion and abortion rights. I fully support any person's right to personal beliefs about abortion, but the government can't take the views of religious organizations into account if they want to create a coherent set of laws. That becomes glaringly obvious in the conversation you're about to hear. My co-host Christine suggested this topic, and as soon as she said it, I thought, Rabbi Paula. Rabbi Paula Marcus is a senior rabbi at the temple that helped us raise our children. She is a thoughtful leader, respectful of everyone. I had no idea what her views on abortion were when I contacted her, but I knew they'd be thoughtful. I wasn't disappointed. Rabbi Paula brought in two other religious leaders from our community who were willing to speak about their nuanced views of abortion. And their conversation makes clear that there is no monolithic stance on abortion in the religious community of our pluralistic nation. Listen in. Welcome to Talk of the Bay, KSQD's local news program brought to you every weekday at 5 p.m. I'm your host, Suki Wessling.
And I'm your co-host, Christine Barrington.
Today, we are hosting a panel discussion on a very sensitive topic, and we thank our guests for their willingness to speak out on a subject that is so politically charged. On the political side of the abortion debate, we often hear that this is an issue that pits religious people against secular people. However, the reality is much more nuanced, as it often is when you drill down into arguments that have become extremely polemical. Political support for or against abortion rights masks the nuanced and complex decisions that many people who practice religions often make. In fact, one person we approached for this discussion turned us down because their own political views about abortion rights directly contradict the religion they are ordained by. That's not uncommon. For example, 47% of American Catholics support legal abortion in all or most cases, despite their church's absolute stand against it.
Many religious leaders are faced with reconciling the realities of the modern world with the fact that the texts that form the basis of their religion were written hundreds or thousands of years ago. We live in a world full of information that people in ancient times didn't have, and we live in a political democracy in which our government is charged with leading people whose religious views span a wide range. Our decisions now are so much more complex precisely because we have so much more information and freedom of choice in modern times that practitioners of these faiths did not have in the past. The three faith leaders on our panel today have agreed to speak about this complex issue, and we are hoping to give them the time and freedom to explore the nuances that are missing from so many public discussions. Senior Rabbi Paula Marcus has served Temple Bethel since 1979. Rabbi Marcus sees activism and social justice as an important part of Jewish values. She is one of the co-founders of Out in Our Faith, an interfaith LGBTQ network, and a leader in the Santa Cruz Tent of Abraham Project. Welcome, Rabbi Paula Marcus.
Thank you for having me.
The Reverend Tara Collier Young is the affiliated community minister with the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Santa Cruz County. Her ministry, Five Seeds Ministry, includes communication and justice for all with a focus on reproductive justice and respectful conversations, sharing information and perspectives. Welcome, Reverend Tara.
I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
And the Reverend David Patti is pastor at Peace United Church of Christ, a progressive Santa Cruz congregation. An ordained minister since 1988, he has served as pastor in Connecticut, Ohio, and Illinois, and brings that wide national perspective with him. Welcome, Pastor Dave.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
It's great to be here with you all. And I understand before we start that you three do know each other and have had conversations. And Rabbi Paula, would you just start by talking about how you three do connect in the community?
Thanks for asking, Suki. So I have to admit that it's been not that long a time that I've been working with these two wonderful colleagues, and we've done some mostly throughout in our faith, which is our LGBTQ plus inclusion group, but there have been other activities that your names have popped up, both the two of you. And I've been just really impressed by what you share, your thoughtfulness, and the ways in which you think about your communities and the intersection of your community with the larger community. And so that, to me, to have colleagues who are very much about doing the work together is key. And that's why I feel so excited about getting to do this together with you. And when the invitation was extended, it was clear that I was going to invite you. And there are others who could be part of this conversation, and we are hoping will be in the future.
Great. Well, as a starting point, I wondered if each of you could describe sort of in general terms your faith's official approach to abortion as a personal decision and as a political right, so that the listeners can understand where you're coming from in your faith tradition. And you might personally, as you know, as we know, not everybody follows exactly what the dictates of their organization might be, or you might want to talk about how your particular organization is different from the larger organization that you might be part of, however you want to approach it. But just so we get a sense, the listeners get a sense of who we're talking to and where you're coming from. So Pastor Dave, would you start us out?
Well, I'm a minister of the United Church of Christ. Sometimes the funny line that I use is that we're what happened to the pilgrims. In our tradition, we are reluctant to be overly legalistic, draw fine lines and directives. But we do very much in our reading of Scripture and in our celebration of the tradition from which we come, in our living relationship with God, we do emphasize the conscience of the believer and the dignity of persons created in the image of God, and that there should be respect and justice. So out of that sense of the tradition and the teaching of my tradition, I would say a couple of things pastorally. I've yet to meet a person who likes abortion, right? Nobody likes that. This is part of the difficult reality of living to glorify God and to serve God's will for justice and peace in the world. But we do teach that persons are to be respected as created in the image of God, that women are persons, and that the autonomy of their bodies and the dignity of their person must be respected. It's a complicated issue. There are lots of nuances in that, but that's basically where we come down, and affirming the conscience of the believer acting in relationship with God and community.
Thank you. That was really beautifully worded, and interesting to think about how what you said about I have yet to meet a person who likes abortion. This is not something that people approach with joy. Like much of religious teaching is about something that you approach with joy.
As a matter of fact, in my exposure, in my knowledge and relationship with people who have had to make that choice, invariably, it was with people who wanted the child,
right?
who had prayed for a child, mm-hmm. and to whom this was just a heartbreaking, difficult decision, and mm-hmm. and the idea of people who are not involved lovingly and respectfully in those kinds of relationships, imposing themselves on that decision-making process is horrifying to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that brings up something that I know that Christine wants to talk about in a while. I'm seeing a direct relation to something that we spoke about before. So we'll definitely get back to that question mm-hmm. of people being involved in a loving way. Rabbi Paula, can you explain the faith tradition you're coming
yeah,
from?
Yeah, I've got so much to say. So hopefully you'll cut me off if I go on and on and on. But I want to highlight something that I think is really, really important when it comes to Jewish tradition, which is, you know, 10 Jews, 20 opinions, right? That's the joke. Like, you know, everyone has at least two or three. So the ongoing nature of debate and conversation is incredibly important in Jewish tradition. And there's even this idea that revelation is an ongoing process. It didn't just happen at Sinai once. And there's also a tradition that when the Jews, received the Torah, there was a mixed multitude of people there, not just those of us that thought of ourselves as Israelites. And this idea that everybody was there, we were all there. So, and we each received what we received on our own, in our own way. Okay. And that has to do with the plural and the singular versions that we find in the Hebrew language of Revelation. And so I wanted to just kind of say that from the very beginning, that we think of our text as ever evolving. And that being said, I think it's really important also to understand that these texts that we go to the first five books of the Bible, the Torah, and then the rest of the Bible, and then the rabbinic literature that came later, centuries old, they are surprisingly relevant now, remarkably relevant now. When we read in the Bible, as Reverend Dave was saying, when we were reading about this idea of the desire to conceive and the amount of women that we find in the matriarchs who can't have children, right? So that's a big issue that comes up from the very, very beginning with the first matriarch, with Sarah. So this desire, you know, the first commandment that's given in the Bible is be fruitful and multiply. So this emphasis on reproduction is really clear. May have taken that a little too seriously, given overpopulation, but that's another story. But the point I'm trying to make is that in the Bible, it does not tell you that life begins at conception. I'm going to say that again. The Bible does not say that life begins at conception. It begins at birth. So this is relevant. This is an ancient text, which is incredibly relevant now. We put a banner outside we're right off of Soquel and by Porta Gulch and Cabrillo that says reproductive rights is a Jewish value. We've gotten a few phone calls about that. Like, what does that really mean? And I feel as soon as I heard about this banner, I'm like, we're getting that, because I want to make it really clear that that's what it is in the Bible, that you have to understand that this is an ancient text, surprisingly relevant. And so I think that's important to recognize that these ancient texts do have what to say, and that they've been hijacked, right? That to say that this is biblical law is actually a blatant lie, having read right. the Hebrew myself. So just wanted to kind of get that out there. You can tell how passionate I am about
yeah.
that. But I think it's important. And, you know, when we see the first creation of the human being, that person, you know, the divine breathes life into that person. It's not like that person was just, you know, a fetus. The person's taken from the earth and divine breath. That's what makes the person alive. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's important to kind of go back to those Genesis stories that we have to remember really are central to the religious you know, Jewish and Christian traditions, mm-hmm. right? And Muslim traditions, right? Mm-hmm. So I think I've said enough for now.
Okay. Well, thank you.
What's remarkable about what you just brought up is this theme of originalism in a document. Or does it evolve over time? And it just feels like our political document has this mirroring of much of the conflict that's been in religions. Is revelation ongoing? Does the word get to evolve? Or do we always have to hearken back to this fixed point in time? It's just amazing how it's merging. So I'm really appreciate it.
And I want to say to anybody who might be listening to us as we're thinking in terms of the ancient texts and traditions and might be listening with an ear toward constitutional questions, originalism is intellectually dishonest.
You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM. This is Talk of the Bay, and we continue our special panel discussion on abortion and religion. I would say that most people are probably least aware of what the Universalist Church is. And so, Reverend Tara, I would love for you to speak a little bit about what the tradition comes from and what sorts of beliefs about life and abortion you might see from that.
Thank you. I would be delighted to share. Unitarian Universalism is a living tradition. And so we do bring ourselves to the present moment. But we have the sources of the world's religions as reference, as informing, as ethical opportunities for us to engage in the world. What I lift up for now is that we are a covenanted religion. We agree to be in covenant with each other. Our first principle of that covenant is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I just want to have us pause for a moment and imagine a world when every human interaction begins from that principle. All else would just fall nicely into place. But as it turns out, we have to keep going. Our second principle, we call for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. We strive towards acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. One of my favorites, and one that speaks to this conversation we're touching on right now, is a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. We're not told what to believe, but we are accountable to our actions. And we hold each other accountable to our actions. And with that, we have the right of conscience in all decision making. One of our sources are the words and deeds of prophetic people, which challenge us to confront the powers and structures of evil or injustice with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. So where that brings us into this conversation about abortion and religion, we do have self-determination and agency. And Unitarian Universalism holds those as self-evident. We do follow reproductive rights, but most recently, and I want to add currently, we have an action of immediate witness. This is a process that we do at our annual gathering of General Assembly, where we are reframing reproductive rights with reproductive justice. And that invites then all of the intersectionality that comes with it, invites in and centers people of color. And as we had spoken earlier about people who can be pregnant and attending to these people with respect and their due dignity. So there's more on that the action of immediate witness. But I just want to lift up one more part, and that we affirm our commitment to build a world in which all people are able to make choices about their bodies, about their health, that they may live in a safe and thriving community.
Thank you. So it's interesting to me that, well, first of all, what we have here, what we're speaking about, is the intersection of religious teachings and a government that is supposed to be separated from church. And, you know, we are an imperfect union. Democracy will always be imperfect. But there is, and I wanted to throw this first question to Pastor Dave, because one of the things that is very clear is that the push to, if not crack the wall between church and state, possibly even knock it down, comes from Protestant Christians and some Catholics, though Catholics were less gung-ho on breaking that down, because Catholics have been historically discriminated against too. But so I would say that it's largely coming from Christian people who consider themselves practicing Christians. So when you, as a Christian, look at this, how do you consider your political life as an American citizen and your religious and spiritual life? How do you balance those, and where do you see your job being when it comes to our political conversation?
Well, thank you for that small question.
we're not doing the softball questions here today.
Yeah. First of all, in as much as white Anglo-Saxon Protestants began a certain strain, stream of American history, that we associate with the beginnings of the United States of America, they were all about religious liberty. That is, of course, not true. They were all about religious liberty for themselves, and their freedom from constraints and impositions that they had known in Europe. This idea of diversity and pluralism is something that we have grown into. And the founders as such were not part of that earlier religious movement. As a matter of fact, they would have been much more influenced by the Enlightenment. And they were really pushing for a state that was free from religion. Mm-hmm. And so these two streams have kind of merged in an artful and, I think, healthy way, in which that we would recognize as diversity and pluralism. And certainly that's very much a part of my understanding, my part of the Protestant tradition, and my understanding of witnessing to the Jesus message and that relationship, that we're clear about who we are. And in our clarity about who we are, that makes us free and open and confident to engage others where they are, and that we can find our shared purposes and higher callings together. This seems to me to be very much the way Jesus did it. And so not a bad way for Christians to proceed. What you're pointing to, though, Suki, is that we have a wide variety in Protestantism, and Protestantism lends itself to sort of roll your own Christianity. So we have people making it up in all sorts of different ways all along the way. And I want to go back to a word that Rabbi Paula used earlier. Some of it is a flat out hijacking. And it is, you know, some of it, when they talk about their sense of Christian calling and witness, I'm just baffled. I wonder who or what they are talking about. So this openness and diversity, and celebration of diversity that Protestantism has grown into with the awakening in the United States, the shadow side of that is that it can be hijacked for people who have much less sense of Jesus and that tradition and much more sense of what my grandparents and great-grandparents did with it. Did I make that? I mean, it was kind of a big question.
No, did the, you, I was just still processing, but yes, what you're showing is, you know, that when I look at the public perception of the political side of the abortion debate, there's this public perception that Christians are against abortion, but really the variety of opinions is, and you know, very wide. And I want to point out that that I believe your website, I was looking at your church's website, and it says something like, "We are unabashedly Christian" on it, which I thought was really a wonderful statement to remind people, we also represent the word Christian, that there, it's not monolithic. And as you said, I loved your, very Santa Cruz of you to say, it's a roll your own religion. But that's very true of Protestantism. And I think that a lot of people don't know much about the history of religion in this country.
Yeah.
So Rabbi Paula, I want to, go ahead.
Yeah. I loved so much what, first of all, you know, both of you, Reverend David and Pastor Tara, both of what you had to share was just so moving to me. And I mean, that word hijacking to me is a very important word too, because people think of this as freedom of religion being perverted. That, to me, that's what we're looking at right here, is that sense that we are free to practice the religion that we are born into, that we choose. I mean, this to me takes that away. The politics of it takes that away, that freedom to be able to practice our religion. And I love what Rabbi Barry Silver, who is the rabbi of the congregation in Tampa, Lador Vador, who has brought a suit against the state about this particular issue of reproductive rights, he talks about it as theocratic tyranny. Mm-hmm. And that, and by the way, he's also an attorney, which I didn't know. I'm like, wow, this rabbi's taking a legal side. He's also a lawyer, so that's good to know. But that term theocratic tyranny, to me, really just, it's imposing one particular interpretation of a religious idea, which is not, as I said, grounded in the primary text of the Bible, and imposing it on all the other religions. You know, there are different traditions have different ideas, you know. So, for instance, I've heard this shared before, you know, some religions don't take in alcohol, but that doesn't mean that you can't, other people can't drink, you know what I mean? It's just right. Alcohol. It's just saying, this is my idea of what I think religion says. And again, you know, we got a phone call about the banner. Well, don't Jews believe in the sanctity of life? Like, how can you support reproductive rights? I'm like, yes, we do. And life begins at birth. And, you know, there, well, what about the spirit of the embryo? I'm saying, do you have factual analysis about what spirit and embryo has. Like, you know, this is the way that we look at it. This is a new law. It's not found in the Torah. And right, and if I'm getting this right, and you two can, all of you can check me, Jesus said, I came to change not a jot or a tittle of the law.
Yes.
So,
Paula, I want to quickly connect something that you just said to something that Suki said, and then get out of the way because I want to hear from Tara. But you put your finger on a terrific historical example. There are some traditions that don't drink. And as a matter of fact, prohibition really came out of the Christian, liberal Christian, social gospel movement. You know, what is it that's blighting our inner cities and terrible for all of these immigrants? Alcohol. So we're going to ban it, right? And it didn't work. And it didn't work because there was a very narrow appreciation of what that meant and what the implications were. And that, in fact, it was not serving the aims of the social gospel movement, quite the opposite. So you've really put your finger on, I think, quite a good example of where that goes awry.
Listeners, this conversation recorded in the summer of 2022 is part of a series of shows that programmers on KSQD have aired since the Supreme Court's Dobbs v. Jackson decision. Please find other shows in this series at ksqd.org/abortion2022. So, Tara, I'd love to hear from you, Reverend Tara, as well, about the point of view of, since you're coming from a tradition that integrates a lot of different religious perspectives, and also you are also here in the United States, citizen of our democratic government. How do you see this connection between your faith practice and the government making laws that may infringe on or oppose your faith practice?
I'll lift up another one of our principles, that it's the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large. And this is faith in the voters, and that people are going to be informed voters. I wanted to just touch on something, that part of the reason why I think that Christianity took this issue and has run with it as far as they have and brought it into the political arena is that it is a trauma and it is a tragedy. And the truth is, abortion and the need for birth control has been with humanity since the beginning of time. So why it got brought up in this last, let's say, 20 years, well, since Roe v. Wade, so we could say that the last 60 years, I think is that there is a lot of power behind it, and we can rally people to vote for me if I touch on something that is really, really sensitive. So in Unitarian Universalism, we honor the discretion of the individual, and we honor that family. That family has a big decision to make. And when committed to bring a child into the world, and when committed to keeping that child in the family, this is where it takes a village to raise the child. And so we must bring that child into a world where emotional intelligence, I'm going to name it, it has to be like a priority. Resources, stability, nonviolence. These are such crucial things. And I know that not everybody has that in their life. And I think that they are right to make that crucial decision to not bring that child into this world at that time. Now, I do want to lift up the other argument that many pro-life people are offering, and I think it's important to recognize, yes, adoption is a viable option. And adoption is also traumatic. It's traumatic for the child who is adopted. It's a traumatic thing for the family, for the deliverer of that baby to give away that child. So, yes, and there are many adopted children who thrive. I don't have any statistics on those who don't, but I do know many adopted children who have suffered under the inquiry of why did my parents give me away? And I don't know that there's anybody who can really answer that question, even the parent who did it. Maybe they can. I don't want to speak for somebody else. So in our politics, we do stand forward and we do uphold the body autonomy, the reproductive rights of the individual and the family. And that is what is most important.
Can I jump in here for just one sec? I know, Christine, you may be going in this direction, but I wanted to just say one thing. I think the piece that is a religious principle for me, too, and it comes in the Bible, is the prioritization of life of the mother over the fetus and their health, meaning physical and mental health, being more important than the embryo. So I think that's also something that we have to consider when we're looking at these questions of the intersection between religious ideas and values and politics, you know. And I mean, we're talking the day after Kansas. So that to me, you know, is also in the back of my mind in terms of this miscalculation. But we don't have to spend a lot of time there. I just think it's really interesting that we're having this conversation today.
Yeah.
Yes.
After what we all saw last night. And the other piece that keeps coming up for me in terms of the religious traditions has to do with what happened with that 10-year-old girl that was raped. And, you know, trying to get her the help that she needed. Or this morning I was listening to NPR, you know, there was a conversation about a mom who was looking for an abortion who had a 10-year-old child with cancer who was supposed to have their surgery. And what that strain would be if that mom had to have, you know, another child and wouldn't be able to take care of the first child. So I think there's a lot of religious principles that are wrapped up, too, in what we're seeing currently unfold in real time.
Right. You know, and what arises for me in this discussion is, so just to give you a little context, I grew up in the Mormon Church. I am no longer a member of the Mormon Church. But it was a very important part of my formative years, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for what it gave me. And it was so formative that when I did my degree and my master's in psychology, I did my thesis on the archetypal forces between orthodoxy and heresy, meaning orthodoxy is like the straightened way, right? It declares this is how it is, this is how it's going to be. You can't deviate. And heresy, the Greek etymon for heresy, heretikos, means one who is able to choose. It's a very high value. And so this ability to get to have nuanced conversations, that's what conferred on a great Greek mind the ability to choose, is that they had delved into the whys and the wherefores so profoundly that they could go their own way outside of the culture in many ways. And so the thing about so many important discussions in life is that they are nuanced, that we need to have this ability to talk about the complexity and not be set on this straightened path. And these are the forces at work, right? And so, Reverend Tara, when you were talking, it reminded me of a couple of things that I witnessed growing up in the Mormon Church that I think are tremendous to this conversation. So the Mormon Church is a lay church, and things happen as a congregation. They really work things out in many ways together. And I remember two instances where the issue of abortion got brought to the congregation. One was a young woman had been raped by a young man in the community. And the family stood up before the entire congregation and said, "We need to tell you what has happened. Our daughter is going to choose to carry this baby. She went through this. This is why you're going to see that she's pregnant. She's not married and raising a child out of wedlock. And we need to get behind her and love her and support her." And that is what happened. I was a very young child. And it just really impressed me. The second story was a husband and wife got up and they wanted to tell the congregation that she was pregnant. The child would be severely impaired if born. The pregnancy was a serious threat to the mother's life, and they were going forward. And they needed our prayers, our help, our blessings. I watched that woman struggle through that pregnancy, gave birth to a child that was wheelchair bound for his entire life, and the congregation circled around her. And so, Reverend Tara, this is what I feel you were talking about. In a really healthy community, which this Mormon congregation was, a person can navigate this choice, a difficult birth, through support of a partner, a family, a community. You know, there's meaning, there's context. But when you force a woman to give birth without all that meaning and context and support, what are you doing to that person? So that's what arose when I heard you speaking, Reverend Tara.
Thank you for lifting up those stories. That is just so remarkable. What comes up for me when I'm hearing you speak is that Unitarian Universalism with the United Church of Christ created a human sexuality curriculum called Our Whole Lives. It is crafted very specifically for each age group, and it starts with kindergarten, maybe even preschool, maybe four-year-olds, into elderhood. Because human sexuality, we have it, but it didn't come with an instruction manual. It's confusing. And so this empowers every human at every stage of life to be informed, to grapple with in a safe community what it means to be a sexual being, or even to confess to oneself, "I am not a sexual being, and I'm okay too." So Our Whole Lives, all religious organizations are invited to engage that curriculum and bring it to their children's Sunday school and religious exploration programs.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Tara.
Thank you. And I want to lift up again, it was a collaborative effort. Yeah. See, so these are two religious traditions. Our directors of religious education came together and created, they developed an amazing program that has just been, the praises have been sung of through the last 25 years.
And Christine, I was very moved for all sorts of reasons, some of them quite personal. I was very moved by those stories. And I have my own connection, which maybe someday you and I will talk about, but I could see that happening. I could feel that happening. And I felt with you the respect and gratitude for that, even as it is a tradition that from which you have separated. But it also brings into some pretty stark relief that the places in the United States that are most vehemently opposed to reproductive rights and choice are places where we find absolutely at the bottom of the scale in terms of community support for infants and children, for families, for pregnant mothers, in all of the measures. Those places have the least support
Right.
For people facing these choices.
Yeah, I'm sort of an Ezra Klein fangirl. And on his podcast, he did a series of interviews about abortion. And one of the people he interviewed was an extremely thoughtful pro-life thinker. And he got her to admit that the stuff that she was saying about what women needed in a post Roe v. Wade world was stuff that Republicans are generally 100% against. And since most, you know, these days we have this world, it was not always this way. I'm going to point out that politically, the support for abortion rights used to not indicate your political party, but now it right. almost certainly does. I mean, there are some on the either side, but that if you go to a place that is dominated by Republicans and thus dominated by pro-life politicians, you are least likely to see the sort of support right. that that women who are giving birth when they are not choosing to would really need. And I want to point out that there is one, just connecting with what the story Christine was saying, there's one Republican politician who on the national stage who bucks this a little bit, which is Mitt Romney, who is Mormon and who has suggested that families need a child credit. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM. This is Talk of the Bay, and we continue our special panel discussion on abortion and religion.
And just one little factoid, just to add to the irony, we're also talking about places where the stream of Protestant Christianity that we've referred to earlier that is most opposed to reproductive rights is most prominent and most politically powerful.
Yes.
Yeah, and powerful is the operative word. That for me, my obsession in life has been this dynamic between, you know, power and the true freedom of one's conscious spirit. And it's amazing to me how these power dynamics couch themselves. Like Rabbi Marcus, you were earlier talking about. Oh, what was that great phrase that lawyer? Theocratic tyranny. Terrorism or
tyranny.
Tyranny. Theocratic tyranny. That this whole ruling, this Dobbs ruling, you can smell the religiosity, you can smell the religion lurking around it. And we're getting gaslit by the Supreme Court. And they're saying, no, 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 that's not what's going on here. This is purely a legal thing. And it's not. It's a power play, right, to control us.
Well, and that's kind of where I wanted to go, is this question of choice, you know, and how do we define this? I mean, I feel like I want to call people who are opposed to choice anti-choice. To me, it's not about, and I don't want to make anybody wrong, but to me, pro-life doesn't really describe what this is. To me, it's anti-choice. And, you know, there's a section in Deuteronomy where it says, you know, I place before you, you know, the blessings and the curses, ubachartem b'chaim, choose life. And what does that mean? And that's not just one community saying to another community, this is what life means. That's the part that's very, very difficult for me. And, you know, the other part of all of this that we're haven't named yet is the slippery slope concept, where I was in California for Prop 8. You know, I don't know if the rest of you were probably, I know, Suki, you were here. I'm not sure if everybody else was here. And I just remember.
I was in Illinois.
This was before before your time, Pastor Dave. But let me tell you.
Rabbi Paula, remind us what that was.
So, yeah, I was just going to say. So Prop 8 was an anti-gay marriage proposition. And it was, you know, heavily funded. Sorry, Christine, but by the Mormon Church.
I know.
I know. And the part that I want, the reason I'm telling the story, okay, is because what we decided to do is after the decision came down, we did a vigil down at the clock tower And then we all hiked up to Peace United, which at the time was called First Congregational Church, Santa Cruz First Congregational Church. And we were all in the sanctuary, you know, and we were, most of us were not shocked, but clearly distressed. And we had a person who had just started coming to Peace United stand up and talk about what he lived through as a gay man in the military and in the Mormon church. Many of you might remember Connell, some of you, I don't know. And he was crying about what his life was like to be not given a choice, to not be given a choice to be an out gay man. He since has moved back to be with his family, but he's a Mormon scholar. Like he's in all of the, you know, he speaks at conferences and he's in all of the different, periodicals. And he was just saying, he said, I was forced to get married and I wasn't given a choice to be who I truly am. And right. So whether we're right. talking about reproductive rights, gay marriage, interracial marriage, it's all there. It's mm-hmm. The playbook is there. And so I think one of the reasons why what happened in Kansas was so important is because it was a pushback on this is not where most people land in this country. And if we are following a religious tradition, we are given a choice. And that to me has to be really, really important, is that we have to be given a choice to live with integrity and live our lives with integrity. And there's a lot of calculations that go on, you know, whether it's people who can't afford to have another child or all kinds of reasons that people make this choice. So I just think that that concept is really important.
Yeah, and that connects in with me to what Reverend Tara was saying about the individual and respecting the individual, that this is so much also connecting back into the political thing. What does our Constitution guarantee us? It's all about the individual and our obligations as a society to do the right thing for the society and the individual and try to balance those. And sometimes, of course, it'll come out in a way that we don't like, but the attempt is always necessary to balance that when we can and to look at the individual. And it does seem that so many people are unwilling to look at the messiness. I mean, there are easier abortion choices. You know, I've known a lot of women who tell me when I was 18, I was just about to go to college. It was just really the wrong time for me. I didn't have to think about it. It was the right thing to do. And I'm glad. And there are women who say that, but like you said, it's not something that people approach with joy or do because they want to. It's just, for some people, it's not a hugely difficult part of their life that they go through. But for everyone else, it's an enormous choice. And to disrespect the individual and make it sound as if they aren't giving it that thought.
Tara. Something I would like to bring up in this regard, and it does feel political, so I'm going to be very tender with it, but I think it needs naming. There is a lot of pushback against what we could call white supremacy culture. And in the white supremacy culture, it is a domineering behavior, practice. And so when a person or when a demographics privileges, and I'm going to say unearned privileges, and that's a term that it takes a lot of courage to admit that we have unearned privileges. And I want to lift up, if anybody wants to read, Peggy McIntosh wrote a fabulous essay called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. So have a look at that and see where you fit in that. And I'm saying this to our listeners. But what I'm intuiting is that because the white supremacy culture is being named, and the behavior that white European people imposed upon the native people of this land, and that they brought the Black African people, all of that is being called out. And it's kind of freaking out the white supremacy culture. So they're going to oppress what they can. And one thing that they have felt like they've had the finger on the head of is womankind. And one of the surest ways to oppress us is to, well, rape and incest. Those two things are just the most deplorable things that ever happened to a woman. And I think it's deplorable that a man is imposing that on himself too. I think that it harms everybody. But to impose this oppression on women, to force them to go through with an unintended, and the most grievous of it all is an unsustainable pregnancy, is, I think that it is a backlash.
Well, I think you're right to point to this surging authoritarianism, Tara. And I think it is part of what's sometimes referred to as the culture wars. And in this particular instance, in this ongoing example, the battlefield is women's bodies.
Well, it's women's bodies, people of color, trans people. It's like, you know, it's all of the quote unquote scary. They're going to come take our guns away. I mean, it's really all of it. And I think that, one of the people who I really appreciate, and yes, I love that article, I thought it was really important, is Eric Ward, who wrote a piece in 2017 called Skin in the Game. And he talks about white nationalism as a real threat back in, 2017, but he identified it earlier because he's a heavy metal musician, a black man in Portland. And he talks about the intersectionality of all of these things and how we all have skin in the game that live on what, people might consider the minorities or the fringes, that this is not just one, like I said, it's not a one-off. I think that it is true that people see women as more vulnerable. I mean, I'll never forget that in 2016, Bookshop Santa Cruz had a public reading of The Handmaid's Tale. It was like, but yeah, that's what I think that is. Naming that is really, really important. And to say that there is fear involved. And so how do we address the fear underneath all of that? And say, this is really about all of us living together, to emulate the rainbow. Like this is, that covenant that was made in the beginning, that we have an obligation to each other and to the earth, and that this is what we're going to be putting into practice. If we want to go back to biblical values, let's go back to that. Let's go back to the origin stories.
Yeah. And as a Christian, I would say with this authoritarianism that claims Christ, how in the world do you get that from Jesus? I mean, well, how did that happen?
Jesus was a liberal.
Jesus was a liberal, and but right now I'm having this image of the Garden of Eden. And kind of wondering if a lot of this doesn't stem from this origin myth that it was Eve that screwed it up, right? Eve, like I thought about this a lot, in the church. And I was like, gee, well, it was a snake, but she succumbed. But I was kind of proud of her. I'm like, dang it, if I was in the Garden of Eden, I'd want to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil too.
Absolutely.
That was brave. She was a heretic.
Absolutely.
And yet blamed women.
There's not an understanding of the evolution of the divine. When you freeze that frame, you're not understanding that Eve was teaching God something. And there's all these rabbinic stories about God's like, let's make people in our image. That's the language that's used. It's let's make. It's not, I'm going to go make people. Let's make, humans in our image. And some of the angels were like, no, that's a really bad idea. Don't go there. That's going to lead to disaster. And there's also traditions that there was 800 or so, 900 worlds created before this world. So the rabbis go crazy with all that, right? But the angels were like, let's not do that. It's going to go wrong. And then God has to learn. God has to learn whether it's through the Eve and the apple, and then, you know, whether it's Noah, and then it's Cain and Abel. It's like, how many times do we have to screw this thing up, you know, to teach God, this is radical, a lesson about what it is to be human, and mm-hmm. how do we interact with that divine spirit within each and every one of us? And, you know, when God breathes life into us, then it's, you know, we got to choose. We're choosing.
Well, that is some nuanced thinking, right?
Yeah, rabbis like that. Yeah. Religious leaders like that. I mean, that's why we're doing this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And is it the job of religious teachers to help their congregations to learn to think in complex ways?
Yes, because it is our job as witnesses and teachers and pastors to help our people live in relationship with a living God in community. And that involves making choices that affirm life and affirm the relationship. That is our job. This whole idea that when you come to church, you check your brain at the door. That's just anathema.
Yeah.
Well, that is one of the things that Unitarian Universalism really relishes is the witnessing. And like I mentioned earlier, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning is not an easy request. It requires so much thought, so much responsibility, so much exploration and life experiences. And it also allows that we're fallible and we're going to make a mistake, and that we're a community of people who can be with each other in those mistakes. I wanted to lift up one more thing because I wanted to the Unitarian Universalist horn just a tad. In 1963, in Dallas, Texas, of all places, and of actually where I was raised, I grew up in Texas, there was a UU congregation who was a part of the amicus brief to SCOTUS regarding Roe v. Wade. And we were one of the first denominations to formally support a woman's right to choose. So Unitarian Universalism has a long history of being in this relationship. We believe that consent and self-determination are holy.
I also wanted to float something else with you all. I'd be interested in your reaction to this. And I get this idea from Susan Thistlethwaite, a theologian, who wrote an article with her husband, Richard, who is, he's now retired. They're both now retired, but who is a transplant surgeon, actually the head of the department at the University of Chicago. And they wrote an article about the fairly broad and deep ethical consensus that we have at the other end of things, where life as we understand it, even though the body, you know, the heart's beating, and that it's allowable. In fact, it's a good, it's a mitzvah to say, that this chapter of this life is over, and we can take from this body that was once alive organs that can help others to live, and in that sense go on. We have that ethical consensus at that other end where that line is. I wonder if there's any promise for us taking the way we think about the other end of things and applying it to this earlier stage, this beginning stage.
Well, that's big.
That's a, wonderful. You just sort of connected the human experience on both ends, which I think is a wonderful place for us to start to wrap this up. And I have one more question for all of you, but I first want to thank you so much for this amazing conversation. It's just been wonderful to hear your thoughts on this really complicated issue and how beautifully you represent the complexity of human experience. It's just been wonderful. So Rabbi Paula, Reverend Tara, and Pastor Dave, it's been great to talk to you. And I have this one last question. I'd love for each of you to let us know a hope that you have for us as a country, as one people, regardless of our religion, race, or political affiliation. So Rabbi Paula, I'll start with you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, to me, Kansas is hopeful. What happened with the misguided strategy to put something on the ballot that wasn't going to get enough attention or was going to just kind of pass without looking. The young people who got out and talked about this, the people who knocked on doors to have conversations about this, the families who were worried about their daughters or their partners who would be forced to have a child that they didn't want or couldn't sustain or couldn't support. I think that's really, really important. And, you know, like the rest of us, I've been on a number of webinars in the last couple of months about this issue. And I have to say, seeing how many young people of all different genders talking about this and working on this and starting projects to register young voters around this issue has really given me hope. I believe that when people really start to think about it and think about the real religious values that are underlying this, the more conversations we can have about it, the better it's going to be. And I do feel like this has stirred up something that has tipped us over. And we're in it now. We're in that, you know, liminal space where we're still working and we're going to see how things move. But last night was very hopeful to me.
And I understand that the three of you are involved in something that that is coming up. You don't have a date yet, but can you mention it? And I will put it on our podcast page.
Out in Our Faith, which is an interfaith LGBTQ plus inclusion organization, is going to be doing a panel. Probably it's going to look like September. We're having a meeting next Wednesday. But yeah, I mean, if people are interested, they can, I guess, go on the website. We haven't been maintaining it much, but there's also a Facebook page for Out in Our Faith, and you can go on there and we'll post something about where it's going to be and when it's going to be and what it'll be about. But I know the two of my colleagues in Making Good Trouble will be part of that as well. So yeah, there will be an event where we're going to have a community conversation about this.
Great. And we will put it on our podcast page as well on ksqd.org. And so to restate my question, Reverend Tara, a hope that you have for us as a country, as one people, regardless of our religion, race, or political affiliation.
I am by nature a hopeful and optimistic person. I think that humankind is capable of anything that we put our collective thoughts towards, for better or for worse. But I want to lift up a term coined by an academic, and I believe she's at Harvard Divinity School. Her name is Diana Eck. And she created a term in a group called engaged pluralism. And so what this essentially means is that people live their true religion. They live their culture, they are invested in it, and they live through that. And then they bring that to the collective so that we have this aggregate of all of these qualities that can represent, you know, the vastness and the diversity of life. So I'm not going to ask an anti-choice person to embrace something that their heart doesn't feel right about. I am going to ask them to not impose it on other people. And I am willing to listen to their point of view. And I would appreciate a returned respect in that conversation. Yeah. So my hope, and I want to lift up Kansas as well, is that maybe we're at a place where we're at a fevered pitch where this conversation is going to come to some realization where we really just need to listen to each other. We need to take off the blinders, open our hearts, and trust that each human on earth is really doing the best they can.
Yes.
So beautiful. I'll leave it at that for now. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Pastor Dave?
Well, I think I would say pretty much what Paula and Tara have said, that my hope is for engagement, and that out of honest and faithful engagement, we can make a new way. We are honest about our faith and our faith claims, and that we can offer them to each other and receive them from each other in a spirit of generosity, getting past the assumption that I'm going to impose my way or force my way or buy my way, but that engaging each other, we can make a way together. And I think what's been happening to us really calls us to that kind of engagement. And that's my hope for the future.
Listen.
Well, I just want to thank each of you for ending on this vision of this broad-hearted inclusion, right? Everyone's welcome. Everyone gets to share, and this vision of, and we all get to respect each other and where we're coming from. So thank you so much for joining us on Talk of the Bay. I am sure we're going to encounter each other again as this conversation continues within our culture. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christine and I would like to thank Rabbi Paula Marcus, the Reverend Tara Collier-Young, and the Reverend David Patti for their willingness to speak openly and thoughtfully to address the nuances that are so often left out of our political debates about abortion. This conversation, recorded in the summer of 2022, is part of a series of shows that programmers on KSQD have aired since the Supreme Court's Dobbs v. Jackson decision. Please find other shows in this series at ksqd.org/abortion2022.